Accession number 12661, Mr. Jim Ray, reel 21.
Mr. Ray, reel 21. So how did you go about starting with your first 20? I mean, you didn't speak the language, you know. How did you set about it?
Well, language is a problem. And most of the commands were given in half English. Now, the African NCOs, you could speak just fairly average English, you know what I mean, but they could use their commands in their own dialect. Now, first of all, as far as I understand, this Twi, Ga, Hausa, and there's the coastal language. Well, that's Pidgin English.
So these 20 recruits could have four different dialects between
yes,
them?
Yes, but we had to bring them all into one dialect.
So they'd come from they weren't a uniform group, they were just 20 recruits from all over?
From all over the bush, from Northern Territories and some as far as Sierra Leone, and recruited, you know.
How had they been recruited?
Well, you have people in the colonial service, they call them district commissioners, right? Now, two BNCOs, a sergeant major or a sergeant and a coloured sergeant, would go up in a lorry, an army truck, and go up into the northern regions and go to a tribe. First of all, if there's a district commissioner in your area, you go there first. Tell them what you wanted, and you say, right, the best thing you can do, Sergeant Major or so-and-so, is to go to the nearest village, is about 8 miles from here. I'll put a man on the truck to take you there. And his personal servant could speak several languages, you know, plus very good English. And from the DCs, we used to go up into the bush to this encampment, native encampment, and it was just circular huts with a big thatch on, you know, and you had a chief. If it was a big area, it would be a chief, and if it was a small area, it would be a headman. And explain what we wanted, how many men we wanted, for the finest men in his tribe to be soldiers for the King of England. And the headman would have his elders around, so he'd get all the people out, all the male members, and used to get them as near to 18 as possible, you know. But out there it's really primitive. I mean, there are no records of births, deaths, or even marriages. And to speak honestly, all these tribes have different tribal marks on the faces. If they're not on the faces, they're on the chest or the stomach, and like beads parallel to each other. They're there for a purpose. If any of the children strayed away from the camp to another camp, the other camp could tell exactly where they come from. It should march them all back, you see. That's true. The tribal marks, you could tell whether he's a Moshi, a Gruma, a Degati, Farafara, Sisala. There are about 161 different tribes who were all named like that, you know. And they all have different dialects anyway, for a start. Anyway, to get them at these, all the men, you know, and look at them. And see what kind of shape they were in first, like, and have a look at the teeth, and Sergeant Major say, well, we'll take him. You always get the best and the strongest, you know, get the best you can. And they're all there, they're all quite willing, standing straight for it. All they had on was a little bit of covering around the lower half, and a little bit of cloth slung over the shoulders. Say, right, you get in the truck, and they had an interpreter. Get in the truck and take the little bits and bobs with them, you know, in a bundle. You get in, another one. This one. We'll have this one. You take about 10 or about a dozen of the best of that tribe and say that out to the headman. The headman would speak in his language, you know. If you say, you're going to be soldiers to the king now. You're going to be proper soldiers and proper men kind, you know. Don't let us down, in other words, like that. And the women folk were out, some of them were even married, as young as 15 and 16. The women were there, and they all started waving, and off we used to go and take them down to the barracks in the truck, used to get a feed at that end. The DC used to generally lay something on for us. And a drink, of course, he was all right. I would like a job like it. Smashing. Get them all in, offload, get them into a barrack room on their own, and there's a charpoys. You know what a charpoy is, don't you?
You just explain.
A charpoy is a wooden frame, about 6 feet long, a yard and 3 feet wide, and about a foot off the floor. And inside the frame is woven up crossways and up and down. It's like rope, made of rope, interwound. Quite springy when it's taut. And then they would get the blanket, blankets, and spread them on there. And they're issued blankets, by the way, and a pillow. There weren't any what they call biscuits out there. We didn't even have any palliasses until the supplies came in. Anyway, they got made comfortable.
Were they issued with a uniform straight away?
Yes. The next day they used to get sized up with the uniforms. They used to get a pair of shorts, a pair of putties, a pair of boots, two pair of socks. And they used to wear a short jacket. Buttons up the front. Well, 6 buttons up the front with a high collar, and they got issued with a tarbush, fez cap, with a black tassel on, a cap badge, and they got, and it was really funny. I was acting quartermaster as well, QM. Getting all this stuff and issuing it out, and the company commander, we got the company commander eventually, and then we got a lieutenant. The European officers, they infiltrated later, you see, into our camp, and while I was doing CQMS, making all the invoices out, that was quite laughable, because they put a pair of boots on, they tried to put the socks over the boots, they'd never seen boots before, and they had to show them how to put the laces in the boots, put the socks on, natives have big feet for a start, starters, and they're made wide because the feet, native feet, they are wide, you see, because they never wear no footwear. Naturally, they're more like little hoofs than feet. And somewhere used to put the wrong boot on the other foot, and they used to lace them up and look comical when they stood up. Get them sat down, put the boots on right, and the one on the left. Things like that, you're really, really basic. And how to put the putties on.
That caused English troops problems, didn't it, putties?
Yeah. And I will say this, once you get them taught on that special subject, they'll learn it, snap it up quick. They're very quick on the uptake to learn.
So this was your first 20 you'd got. This is when you were at the fort.
Yeah.
So what were you doing with them there? Because you wouldn't know what you were doing then, would you, yourself? Particularly in dealing with African troops.
Yes, well, you had Africans to help you out, you know. And first of all, get them three ranks. That was the first thing to do, right? Fall in. So make them fall in three ranks, disperse them. And used to give the command in their language, and then English. So they had to learn too, and I had to learn too at the same time by listening to the African sergeants, you know, because the African sergeants could speak good, decent pidgin English.
So you'd give the command in English, the African sergeant had repeated,
yes,
and then the two sets, the African soldiers and you, would be learning.
That's right. That was the process. First thing, there were no arms, anything like that. They're just strictly recruits. Learn, turn to the left, turn to the right, stepping off by the left foot in marching order, get them marching round. But we had a big parade ground outside the fort, and we had plenty of scope. And you had four squads separated. I had one, Ginger Stockton had one, and Sergeant so-and-so, he had a one, and Sergeant so-and-so, he had a one. And we used to get as far apart as we could, because get the command, so we could hear commands going all over this area, you know. And we used to start at about 8 o'clock in the morning, at about 7, get them all out, pray at 8 o'clock in the morning. And we used to work right through to 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then, if on the cooler season, which was then, we used to start around about half past 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon up to about 4 or 5 in the evening. All that time, learning, punching into them, day after day, day after day. Saturday, used to have Saturday, we used to have a half day, we knocked off at 12 o'clock from 8 till 12. The rest of the day was our own. But during, like I've always done when I was out there, I used to take an interest in them, and I used to go over into their lines, the African lines. They lived in like kraals, mud huts, in lines, you know, some of them, and the others used to live in the fort. So I used to get them round in a circle. I used to get, when I went off parade and had a tea, which is mainly a couple of slices of bread and jam and some fruit. It's a fruit salad, proper fruit salad, you know, not out of tins. A cup of tea or coffee. I'd put a pair of slacks on, some mosquito boots and a light shirt. Just leave a shirt and go over. I used to get them all in a ring. I used to answer some questions. And I used to have the African sergeant or outfit and sergeant major. And we used to put questions, you know. Well, simple things. Put up your left arm. Put his left arm down. Right arm. Put your right arm up. Things like that, you know. And the language and that taught them left and right as well. And Sergeant Major used to talk to them. I used to chat to them and tell them that we're training to be proper soldiers, and they will be. And later on, there'll be issues with rifles, like the hunters do. The white man, the Baturi, when they go hunting with rifles, and they go, oh, they wanted a rifle. They're looking forward to it.
How about your own learning the languages? Which language did you try and learn bits of all of them, or did you concentrate on one?
One. Hausa.
Was that the main one? It's the one I'd heard.
Hausa.
Of,
right? Yeah, Hausa.
How did you go about learning it?
Well, listening to the words of command, first of all. And sometimes when Sergeant Major was conversing with one of the soldiers, I would listen to it and I'd say, "You say again, Sergeant Major?" And he'd repeat it. So I said, "Well, what does that mean, Sergeant Major?" "Oh, stand up straight. Don't stand up straight." Or you would say, "Don, it's such words as Biribingana." "Well, what does that mean?" "Keep quiet." "Karakagudu" means "don't run away when they're marching." You know. "Kajiko, you here?" "Naji, I here." Little words like that.
Was it just words to do with ordering people about, or did you learn, you know, how to talk socially?
First of all, the Hausa language, it is a good language, but you've got to, it's very deep, because Hausa is like English language. Some parts of the Nigerian districts have a dialect, same as Geordie and Yorkshireman, you see, so you've got to be very careful on the word you choose. It could be said the same, that a same, different ring, the same command with a different ring to it, you see. It's tricky, but I could hold me on and do bits of things, make them understand. They like that. They like that. Said, the Baturi wants to, he's good, he wants to learn our language and all, you see, and he's interested. To be interested in the troops was the main thing.
Hey, you were. You seem to have taken to the African soldier.
Of course. I took to them as I was normally any recruit, and they got set.
Did you look down on them at all?
No. I thought, privately, I thought, well, what a shower I've got. Oh, what a heap. Have I got to make something out of this lot, you know?
Was that because they were African? Or because they just were a shower, you know?
Yeah, with Africans.
It was that made you look down on them at first?
At first, I said, I thought, well, what have I let myself in for, you know?
So at first you did look down on them, you were pessimistic?
Yeah, I was reluctant to say, well, they're all right, when I knew they weren't. I would only say, now when I saw improvement, then my attitude changed completely, because I knew these Africans, even though they were strangers, I was a stranger to them. They used to be nervous. They had a nervous disposition. I hadn't, so I had to make them less nervous and more reliant on me and myself upon them. So there's a close mental cooperation between the black and the white. You understand, Peter? You know what I'm driving at. For instance, I'll give you an example, Pete, and I've said this many times, and Dot knows what I've said. We got a Muhammad Ali. He came from nowhere, and he appeared on the Orly Room. This is when I was at Takoradi. And we had, I think, between us, going through all this turmoil, we formed battalions out of platoons. Ginger Stockton, he's a Cumberland lad. He came on parade, and he was come where I was, and he had them all in perfect new munition in arms drill, exactly as the European troops. He said to me, what period of training are they in, Jim? I said, this is their sixth week. He says, what? Sixth week. And we train them right from raw, out the bush. He says, by Christ, this is they've got precision, haven't they? I said, I'll tell you something else, Ginger. These people have a precision in their body, inasmuch they have a particular movement on their own. In time, because they're so used to hearing drum beats night after night in their own villages. See, when going by the beat, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, just like a drum, bum, 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 bum. And with it being a heavy infantry, a slow pace of marching, about 120, same thing, heavy infantry marching, not quick, not light infantry. They could get that rhythm, and they could swing their arms up shoulder level. So the beat was in the mind of arms drill. The position was there, even to presenting arms. With the bayonets on as well, you fix, unfix bayonets.
So that gives us an idea. So the first 20, you were just doing this drill with them. How long were you doing that with them for, at the fort?
Well, day after day, week after week, under 6 weeks, we got them to tip-top drill. An arms drill, marching, wheeling, counter-marching, halting, saluting to the front, retiring, saluting to the left, saluting to the right, all that in for 6 weeks. So
now, would you have was that faster or slower than British troops would have been? It's about the same, isn't it?
Quicker. Mm-hmm. It was marvellous how they picked it up. Yes.
So, with that basic drill, they were.
Yes.
If you'd had a squad of lads in a Bransworth depot, you'd have they'd have been slower to pick that look.
Slightly slower than the Africans. They were keen. I mean, European to European, there's a little bit of a lackadaisical among it, you know what I mean. And they were all dead keen. They wanted to be soldiers.
So how long were you at the fort before you went? Because you went to Takoradi.
Well, I think...
Was that the only squad you had there?
Oh, no, I had more squads than that. We always used to keep a nucleus behind and put the squads in with them, you know, mingle them in with them to march in unison with the ones that already knew the stuff. So one helped the other, and you could allow for mistakes. And there was a pattern of word of command and copying till you got them all together. And you pick them out, you know. And
so, would it be true to say that while you were training at the fort, you were being trained, ready to go out with the battalions as a dealer with it, so that you could train African troops?
Because I took them out with me. I went to Burma with these lads. I knew what they were. I knew the potential. Oh yes, I knew once I was over there, I was bound for little things. I wouldn't.
So, but you, where did you do most of the training, at Takoradi or at the fort?
First of all, we, from our nucleus of troops, we made a battalion, That's over 700 men. Now then.
And they gradually built up at the fort, did they?
At the fort, and outside the fort as well, because we get an enlargement, you see. Now,
and that was all gradually building up.
That is right.
Now, while you were at the fort, did you take them in weapons drill at all, actually?
Yes, yes.
So that's before you went on to Takarari?
That's right, yes.
And what was the weapons drill like then? What weapons did you take them in? I mean,
well, we only had the rifle.
The Lee Enfield?
Lee Enfield, yes.
And how did they take to that?
Well, to them, it was a strange weapon. And when we got them to, when we took them over onto the rifle range, and when they fired their first shot, they wondered what hit them. You know what I mean? Because of the kick. And the aiming wasn't as good as what we expected, but we took them through the basics again. We thought we'd had them like trained to that.
So when you took them down the range, you thought they'd know how to shoot. You taught them how to fire and aim.
How to take an aim and what it looked like looking through the...
But you were disappointed by the practice.
Yeah. Yes.
So you did it again?
Yes, I think so as well, because in the butts, you know, you had your targets, like your four foot targets, and your back 200 yards anyway. That was your first one. And you had them all lined up, and you had butt register and a butt register, and you had a firing point register. And they just fired in their own time, and they had sandbags for support, you know. And you watch each particular target, and you could see the embankment, and you could see the targets, plain, very plain, you know, in the sunlight. And as you're walking up and down, and you're 5 point in point, and I should go around watching different shots. I thought, oh, hell, he's bloody miles off the target. What the hell is he doing? But when I saw them firing their first five rounds, Pete, it was the actually kick of the rifle that shocked them first. They didn't realise what was happening. It was the first round of 303 they've fired in their lives out of a gun. Because they've never seen a gun hardly, except if they'd seen any hunters.
And so they reacted worse than, say, the DLI troops would have done.
On that score, yes. So we had to take them gradually after that. Close down and take them singly by putting them down. And we used to put an aiming corrector on. It was a clip used to go on where the backsight was. He could look through from the backsight to the foresight, and I could see by on this side what he was aiming at. I could see it. What he was aiming at was like on a prism. And I could watch, and I'd say, I go, Uncle Lee, I go. Yeah, I can.
And that means?
Steady to the left or to the right. Down, Uncle Lee. But. Oh, yeah, buy it. Fire. And I could see. And to tell them, you know, when you're firing, not to jerk the trigger. Squeeze, Anthony, Duba means squeeze, go steady, squeeze, Duba, look, squeeze, and we used to go off, and he used to hit the target. And then once he got that on, he was all right. So we did that individually. Now, they used to come back, go right to, let them in single lines, you know, ready to go down. And the last man, they would have a chat to each other. They'd say, ah, I know how to hit the target. And I'll tell you what happens when you go down here. And he was telling me what happened when he was there, you see. And the next man would come down, and he would be tapping a bit better. So they were telling each other, by the time they were going through to the corrector, the NCO, lying beside the firing, he knew exactly nearly what to do. All he had to do was watch, now he was